Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, beautiful Thursday morning. Yes, it is raining here in New York, but still it is a beautiful Thursday morning because finally my gardens and lawn are all getting some water, which was much needed. But anyway, I am so happy to be here with you today. I'm returning back from Burning Man, which was quite an amazing event and experience for me. For those of you that do not know about Burning Man, it's really an amazing cultural phenomena. And on the West Coast, everyone knows about Burning Man because you can just hop in your car and drive there. On the East Coast, it's a much bigger deal to go to Burning Man, a much bigger challenge because you have to fly, you have to all your equipment that you need for your bedding, for, you know, housing for a week, living in the desert, which has some grueling conditions of wind and sandstorms and lots of heat. And then at night it's very cold. So there's lots of environmental challenges that one has to deal with. And so when you have to fly there, it makes it much more challenging. But the difference of people just knowing about it, it's just amazing. It's like night and day. You go out there and everybody has heard of Burning Man. And so I flew out early. I flew out 3 days early so that I could stay with a friend in north of San Francisco and cook for a few days before going to Burning Man because I had volunteered to cook for a art camp for a full week. And there were 40 people in this art camp. So I was making breakfasts and dinner every day for these 40 people. And I didn't want to spend my time at Burning Man cooking because I had heard of the conditions and it's just harder. And I just didn't want to spend the time. I wanted to have the time free to roam the desert and see all the artwork that was around and the events that were going on. So I cooked, you know, nonstop for, you know, 60 hours in Northern California. And then I vacuum sealed everything and froze all that could be frozen in these vacuum sealed bags and loaded them into coolers. I had like five 150 quart marine coolers filled with dry ice and all this food, and loaded it into an RV and schlepped out to Nevada, Black Rock City, Nevada, which we went through Reno. It was basically like a seven-hour drive from San Francisco. And loaded it all up onto the RV along with my husband and friends that were coming with us and went to Burning Man. And we first got there in the dark, so, you know, trying to find your way through, you know, a city of 60,000 people. Actually, I think there were 70,000 people, but they weren't all there yet. Trying to find your way. They basically set it up as with all these streets and avenues like a clock. And so the man, which is what they will burn at the end of the week, the man is at the center of this city and at like 6 o'clock. And at 12 o'clock, there is a big sculptural temple that they also burn at the end of the week. And so all of the other camps are set up in a semicircle from 10 o'clock all the way down through 6 o'clock up to 2 o'clock. So there's really nothing between 10 and 2 up by the temple. But then the whole center area where the man is open for people to have art installations. And then all around the man at 6 o'clock are small little art installations as well. And we were in a camp for an art installation called Infinity Boxes. And so everybody in the camp volunteered to work the booth where these boxes were, and these boxes were incredible. They are boxes that you look into, standing up, you look into from all different sides, and you see prisms and different images of your face combined with whoever is looking from the other side. So you see these incredible images of your face, you know, overlaid with somebody else's face, and it's very cool. But the cooking, which I was in charge of, was just amazing. For me, as a chef, as a slow foodie, as a person who has seen the power of what food can do in bringing people together around a communal table, this was just another affirmation for me of the power that food has. We took 40 individuals. You know, everybody came with somebody they knew. So there were couples, and there were, you know, groups of four or groups of six that made up these 40 people. But a lot of people didn't know each other. And the food, which was all vegan for the most part. I had some goat cheese on the side, some feta cheese on the side, but the main food was mostly gluten-free and vegan, was just laid out in, there was abundance of it, there was enough to share with everybody. You know, I had designed a whole menu that included, you know, vegetable curry with, you know, coconut milk and matcha paneer and naan, and then there was barbecued tempeh, there was a Japanese stir fry with nori rolls, there were vegan tamales, there were, what else did I make? Oh, I don't know, there was just so much food. For breakfast, we had pancakes, we had French toast, we had scrambled eggs, we had, always had homemade granola out and yogurt, and so it was just an ongoing feast, and every day around 5 o'clock out came cocktails and poo-poos, meaning a little hors d'oeuvres, and it was just, you know, the kitchen became the heart center of the camp. We all had the shared focus with the art project of the art boxes, but it was just such a wonderful experience, and yet the conditions that I was working in, I was set up in a tent. It was, there were storms of dust, like you would not believe, 40-mile-hour wind storms with dust blowing in your face, blowing into the tent, trying to keep the size down, trying to keep the dust out. Everything you washed within 5 seconds had dust on it, so you had to keep everything you were cooking, you had to keep covering. Every time something was ready, you had to cover it immediately to try to keep it clean. And all I kept thinking about was, oh my God, if the health department could see this. I just can't even fathom how the health department's okay with this. But somehow in Nevada, they get away with it. It would be shut down in a second, I think, in New York. But I know I did it really well. I mean, I kept everything covered, and everybody, you know, I don't think anybody was eating the dirt in my food. But it was a challenge, and it was really wonderful coming together. Everybody pitched in. At no point did I really feel burdened, which, of course, was a worry of mine. I didn't want to feel like I was a slave to everybody and working the whole time. I really had time after breakfast to go out all day until 5 o'clock when I came back to start doing it again. And then when dinner was over, I had all evening to go out. And people, when I say all evening, people went 24/7. I mean, there were parties going on. There's huge bars. I mean, go online, look up Burning Man 2015 and see some of the photos out there. It's just amazing. I put some up on my blog if you wanted to see that. But it really, really was amazing. So I'm a little bit out of the news, but I did try to catch up so that I could talk to you about what was going on. We found a very interesting article that somebody had posted on their theory on why there's so many struggles today with people getting pregnant. Infertility is, you know, definitely an issue that people are struggling with, and it seems like it's more so now than it used to be. And some of the reasons why are explored in this person's philosophy. So that's up on my post if you want to check that out. There's also an article about tilapia. Tilapia is a fish that just kind of came out of nowhere and became everywhere. You see tilapia everywhere. And tilapia is a fish that is only farm raised, and they are fed fish pellets that are made from GMO soy and corn. So you're eating fish that are eating genetically modified foods, and they're eating foods that they are not really designed to be eating. Fish are supposed to be eating other fish or plankton, seaweed, you know, things that grow in the ocean. So when you are eating tilapia, I know many of us are eating fish because we know it's healthy for us and we want to get those omega-3s. But the nutritional value of fish that are farm-raised is very different than fish that are raised in the wild. They do not have all the same omega-3s, and they are not as healthy and are not assimilated by our bodies the same way. Plus, you're getting second-hand contamination of the GMOs by eating those fish. So think twice before ordering tilapia. And there's actually a great little video that I shared on my website from Alan Kapuler, who talks about GMOs and what it's doing to us and to the planet. So if you have a moment, check that out. Also, I always have petitions on my website that I ask you to sign, because it's so important for us all to take action and to get politically involved. That's one thing that I found as I got older. I realized that to really make change, you do have to get involved in your local politics. We need to make a change, and the only way that we as people can compete with the money that the Koch brothers and the big corporations like Monsanto and Syngenta have is by the numbers. And so we all need to band together and make our voices heard so that our elected representatives cannot deny listening to us, even though the money coming out of those big corporations we can't match. So we need to speak up. One of the things, going back to Burning Man for a minute, is they ask people to bring gifts. It's an economy that's set up only on sharing and giving. There's no monetary exchange that happens. So things like our food, everybody paid ahead of time. There was no exchange of money once you get there. So you need to bring in everything that you're going to use when you go there, and you take everything away, all the garbage, every single bit of trash. There's people that are assigned to stay behind after everybody leaves to pick up every little morsel of anything that might have dropped on the playa, so that there's no impact to the land. But in this philosophy of giving and sharing, they ask people to bring gifts. So we actually brought, you know, we're raising bees here, so I had all this beeswax and I didn't know what to do with it. So we made lip balm, and I bought online the little empty chapstick vessels and made a beeswax concoction with beeswax and coconut oil and some vitamin E oil and a little essential lavender oil, and filled the chapstick holders and made about 300 little chapsticks that I handed out to everyone. And it was a great playa gift because everybody's lips were parched from the dry sun. But anyway, so that was the gift that I gave out. And everybody who brought their own, so many people are bringing Burt's Bees, because Burt's Bees we have known to have been a really great product. And they stand, you know, they really have been in the forefront supporting protecting bees and pollinators. However, an article was just shared with me that I shared up on my newsletter this week, that Burt's Bees, which now has been sold and is owned by the Clorox company, they have joined an organization called the Pollinator Partnership. And this organization on the surface appears to be very concerned about the plight of honeybees, but in reality it's a PR campaign paid for by the Bayer Crop Science Organization to try to diffuse the blame of colony collapse disorder away from the neocontinoid pesticides, which are the things like Roundup, and to try to blame it more on just climate change and the environment. And so there's a petition on my website to ask Burt Bees, or the Clorox company, to break away from the pollinator partnership and to really be more transparent. So please sign on to that. There's also a petition to tell President Obama to not lease out public land to the fossil fuel companies. Right now he has agreed to lease out over 67 million acres, 55 times larger than the Grand Canyon National Park, to fossil fuel industry for extracting oil and gas. And so that's just not okay, especially with his you're talking about being wanting to leave a legacy of being the environmental president and caring about our planet. Leasing public land for the fossil fuel industry is certainly not in alignment with that. So please sign that petition. I want to just tell you about a few things going on in and around the city, especially tonight. Tonight is a big night at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein will be there with the 350.org organization. It's an event called Off and On, the Climate Movement and the Road Through Paris. And this is going to be a multimedia presentation to talk about the current situation with our climate, and what we need to do as a people, again, banding together so that we have the masses of people so our representatives cannot deny hearing us. It's tonight at 6:30 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It's also going to be simulcasted, so you can log on at 6:30. Actually, I think it starts at 7 o'clock, but I have down 6:30. Maybe that's when the doors open. But go onto the website. You can go onto the website either at 350.org or just search Off and On the Climate Movement, and you'll find it, and find out about going or logging on and watching the simulcast with millions of other people. We need to really make our voices heard. And the climate march last year was a really great thing, but then, as you know, right away, the Rockefeller Foundation stopped investing in fossil fuels. But after a little bit of time, the energy starts petering out and you don't hear as much about it. So we need to keep the fight up. So please check in tonight at BAM. This weekend, September 11th and 13th, The Art of Natural Cheesemaking with David Asher, and that's going to be taking place. It's organized by Slow Food USA, so you can go to their website and find out more about that. This Sunday, September 13th, Suffolk County Marathon is taking place, and it's going to end with a taste of Long Island at Heckscher State Park. I will be there participating. Not even sure what they want me to make yet, but I will be there. So hope to see you there. September 17th through the 20th, there's a comprehensive engagement with the regional food system. That's taking place in Liberty, New York. September 19th, Annie Appleseed Project. These are complementary and alternative cancer therapies at St. Bart's Church. It's an all-day program from 9 to 5. The natural nurse, Ellen Kamai, will be there and is organizing this event. So she's a wealth of information. I really recommend doing anything that she's involved with. So that's September 19th. And September 26th is a walk in the woods. Join North Shore Land Alliance for a wonderful opportunity to take a nature walk. And it's taking place in Sayville, the grasslands in West Sayville, an all-day event. You can go to the North Shore Land Alliance for more information about that. And September 26th also is the Long Island Naturally. That's a day of environmental fun and learning out at Manor Farm. This is organized by Starflower Experiences. It's free. It's all day long. There's a big community garage sale that takes place there, or tag sale. You know, people are invited to come and set up tables and share all the treasures they found in their garages. So that's always fun. So come out to that. And September 26th is the Naval Expo in Manhattan, which is a huge event at the Millennium Hotel all day long. So you can look up the Naval Expo Manhattan and find out more information about that. So October 3rd is the Harvest Fest up at Stone Barns Center in Tarrytown. Stone Barns is a great agricultural educational center, and this is their Harvest Fest. So it's from 10 to 3 on October 3rd. October 5th, Just Food is having their Let Us Eat Local. That's an annual event that's always wonderful. And October 6th, the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food is having their Fall Gala, which is also an annual wonderful event. I'll be there serving up some delicious vegan food. So if you can make it to that, please come. Now I'd want to share a recipe with you before I invite my guest. Today I have Ava Chin on. She is the author of the book Eating Wildly and Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal. So stay tuned. She'll be on just in a minute. My recipe this week is spicy eggplant and seitan in garlic ginger sauce. Right now I have lots of eggplant coming out of my garden, so I'm exploring recipes with eggplants. I also have lots of peppers, so I needed to use up some eggplant and peppers. So here we go. I used one pack of seitan. This was, you know, there's all different kinds of packages of seitan. This one was a pound and 2 ounces. And I cooked the seitan separately first before mixing it with the eggplant. So for the seitan, I had one package of the seitan, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 teaspoon minced garlic, 1 teaspoon minced ginger, and 2 jalapeno peppers that I diced up really small. Then I made a sauce with 1/4 cup tamari, 2 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar, 2 tablespoons aji marin, which is a sweet rice wine, 1 tablespoon of honey, and 1 teaspoon of sea salt. And I just set that aside. And then for the eggplant, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 4 medium Japanese eggplants that I sliced at an angle and cut into like two inch thick strips, 1 onion cut into slivers, 1/2 a red pepper cut into strips, and 1/2 a green pepper cut into strips, 2 tablespoons minced garlic, 1 tablespoon minced ginger, 1/2 teaspoon red chili flakes, 1 teaspoon sesame oil, and 1/4 cup of diced scallions. Now, I cooked the seitan separately in a heavy cast iron pan, just sauteed it in the olive oil with the garlic and ginger until it started getting golden brown, added the jalapeno peppers, and just cooked that up. And if you want to splash some tamari on it just to sear it, you can do that as well. Then for the eggplant, this is the first time I ever steamed eggplant. Usually I've taught you guys that when I'm cooking eggplant, because eggplant absorbs so much oil and I don't want so much oil, I usually roast the eggplant in the oven first. But this time someone had suggested I try steaming it, so I did. I took my wok, and you know the wok usually comes with a bamboo basket, and you fill the bottom of the wok with 1 inch of water. You put the eggplant slices into the bamboo basket. You bring the water to a boil, and you put the lid on the wok and steam the eggplant for 8 minutes, about 6 to 8 minutes, just until the eggplant are soft and can be pierced really easily with a fork. Eggplant are one of those vegetables that really need to be soft to be eaten and enjoyed. When they're crunchy in the middle, they just do not taste good. So by steaming it and getting it soft, then you can just cook it up and it doesn't absorb so much oil, and it's wonderful. So I did that first. And then while that was happening, I mixed the sauce with the tamari, the mirin, the honey, the vinegar, and the salt, and I put that in a little bowl and set that aside. And then when the eggplants were soft, I took the basket out of the wok, I dried the wok out, and I put my 2 tablespoons of olive oil into that. Then I added the onions and cooked those just a little bit until they were translucent. Then I added the red and green peppers, the garlic and ginger, and cooked those for a few minutes. Then I added the steamed eggplant in, 1/2 teaspoon of the red chili peppers, and I also added in the sauteed seitan, and I stirred that up just for about 60 seconds, a minute, doesn't take very long. Then you stir in the sauce and just let that cook down for 3 to 5 minutes until the sauce thickens a little bit. I removed it from the heat, and then I just drizzled a little of the dark sesame oil on. And if you have scallions, you can garnish it with some diced scallions, and that's delicious. You can also garnish it with some toasted sesame seeds if you'd like. And that's it. It really cooks up very quickly, and it's so good. So please enjoy that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest today. Ava Chin is the author of Eating Wildly, Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal. And she won first prize into the 2015 MFK Fisher Book Awards for Excellence in Culinary Writing. She also was chosen as one of the best books for 2014 from the Library Journal. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Urban Forager, Los Angeles Times Magazine, The Savoir, The Village Voice, and Eating Well, among others. She's a former slam poet. She's the Associate Professor of Creative Nonfiction at CUNY and a fellow at the New York Institute for Humanities at NYU. And Huffington Post named her as one of the 9 contemporary authors you should be reading. So it's my pleasure. Ava, you on with me?
I am. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm sorry all my ranting and raving at the beginning was so long, but I just had to share my excitement of Burning Man with everybody.
It was really fun to listen to.
Oh, good. Because it was just such a wild experience. Have you ever gone?
I haven't, but I've been to Coachella. Which is different because Coachella is really just more
about the music,
and there's less of artistic economy, an economy of bartering and people communally coming together. But it's also the kind of desert conditions you were talking about, high extreme heat during the day. So I understand.
There's definitely
no foraging there.
No foraging there. There's not one thing that grows there. It's just open and flat. I've never seen anything quite like it. Just open and flat, nothing there. Surrounded by the beautiful Nevada Sierra Mountains. It was just gorgeous. But one thing I didn't even talk about is that there's over 200 art cars, like moving sculptures. You know, to be an art car, you have to be decorated so much that you can't tell what it was before it was an art car. And everything's lit up at night, so you have all these moving, artistic, lit-up sculptures all around this open playa area. It's really wild. But anyway, enough about Burning Man. I want to talk about your book, Eating Wildly. Can you share with us first what inspired you to, well, even before writing the book, what inspired you to start foraging? How did you begin?
Well, I actually began foraging as a child. I grew up in a large apartment building in Queens, and I didn't have access to a garden, but in the back courtyard, wild field garlic, which is also known as wild garlic, was growing amongst the hedges, and it looked just like the scallions and the Chinese chives that my grandfather used to cook with. And I knew it was edible also because when I pulled it out of the ground, it smelled like those scallions my grandfather would cook with. And it had a nice spicy bite to it. And I just loved it. So I was the kind of kid that was getting my hands dirty with wild food from a pretty early age. But I didn't start really foraging in earnest until I was an adult, and it was on the heels of losing my maternal grandmother, who was really my mother figure. And right around that time of loss, I really needed something to sustain me. I'd always been interested in seasonal eating. I was a member of the Park Slope Food Co-op for many years. But, you know, this took it to another level. There was something about learning about the abundance of wild food that was growing all around us and knowing what I could eat and being able to feed myself by my own hands that was just inspiring. And then that, I started writing about it, and that led to the Urban Forager column for the New York Times. And from there, I was writing about things that I found all across the city. I really use I often forage on the college campus that where I teach at the College of Staten Island. So we have a really pristine 220-acre campus. And I'm able to find all sorts of wild mushrooms that are edible and wild greens that are really great. So even though I was writing the Urban Forager and telling people, oh, you know, I saw something growing out of the cracks in the sidewalk, I really don't actually eat from there. I would just note what was growing, and then I would kind of hightail it over to more pristine areas and harvest vegetables from there. But that's where Eating Wildly came out of, the work from the Urban Forager at the Times.
When did that start? When did you start writing for the Times?
I started writing for them in March of 2009. And I started very locally, this hyper-local section of the Times, where my areas were the very urban areas of Fort Greene, Clinton Hill, Brooklyn. And in the beginning, I was really worried that I wouldn't be able to find anything there. But, you know, the weeds are intrepid, and they will grow wherever they can. So I didn't have difficulties finding all sorts of wild edibles and writing about it. So it was a lot of fun. And then eventually people let me go into their backyards and their gardens, and I would tell them about some of the wild weeds that were edible that they were weeding out, they could actually eat. So that was
like
always
dandelions. Fun. Everybody, you know, picks out their dandelions, and they're the best.
That's right.
Wild dandelions.
That's right. And if only folks would stop using herbicides and pesticides on their lawns, which, as you know, are really not great for our environment and for the bees, but instead, you know, just stop using those kinds of things and pick your dandelions and use it in a salad. I like using dandelion greens in a baked pie. It's a little too hot right now to use this recipe, but when the weather gets a little cooler and you want to turn on your oven more often, wild greens pie is a really great thing to do.
Really? How do you do that?
So I basically used a recipe that was based on a friend. Her family is from Corsica, so it was a Corsican family recipe of this wild green tart that they were making. It was a covered pie. And what I wanted to do was to create a New York City version of that. Now, of course, we don't have the same variety of wild greens that they do in the hillsides of Corsica, but mm-hmm. we do have dandelion greens, we do have amaranth, we do have lamb's quarters. Lamb's quarters is related to spinach, quinoa, and beets, and it tastes a lot like spinach when it's cooked. And it grows, throughout the New York City, New York State, and through most of the 50 states. And so I use whatever wild green that I can find that's in season at the time. And then
you said amaranth. Amaranth is also a green?
It is. It is.
Ah.
We know amaranth mostly through, I think, as a grain.
Right.
Right. But it's a wild green as well. And it's often, it's part of the Mediterranean diet. In Greece, they eat amaranth a lot. But here, it's considered a weed, and people just try to weed it out. But it's a really tasty green, and it's very nutritious. It's all of the wild weeds, both the amaranth as well as the dandelion and the lamb's quarters that I mentioned, are much higher in vitamin A and vitamin C than most of our cultivated greens.
Right.
So I really advocate
calcium.
Using them.
I always tell people, I mean, the dark leafy greens is a wonderful source of calcium. You know, if people, you know, are worried about cutting back on dairy products, you know, that
right.
they need it for their calcium. I tell them there's more calcium in their greens than there is in the dairy.
That's right. That's right. So what I do is I round it out with this pie that I make. I use grass-fed ricotta, and I mix it together with maybe half a cup of shredded Gruyere, and I bake it in the oven, and it's a wonderful pie. It's a little bit like an Easter pie, the kind of pie an Italian Easter pie that you get around Easter time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a mix between that and a quiche, I would say.
Right. Right, or it sounds a little like you'd be the inside of a spinach pie.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yum. Sounds great. Thank you.
I will
try that out.
The recipe for that is in the book.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm going to definitely check that out. Now, I know as a chef, when I travel, you know, I'm always looking for good restaurants and trying out the local food. Do you find that you do that as a forager when you travel? Do you, like, look for new wild things, or is it pretty much are you pretty convinced that you find the same things in the same places, or is it different from place to place where you go?
You know, it's both the same and different. So there are some plants, like the lamb's quarters, which is really closely related to spinach, that grows in most states across the country. But you'll see it's got different characteristics in different states. So in Southern California, the lamb's quarters that I've seen has a more deeply verdant green color, right, because it's in that hot, semi-arid desert sun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in New York City, you know, depending on the time of year when you find the lamb's quarters, it doesn't, it looks a little different. But then, you know, there are things that grow that are native to different states that I don't see here, and I'm always excited about finding those. There are things that, so I'll give you an example. I was leading a foraging walk in a nature reserve in Mystic, Connecticut. And on the edge of a reserve, they had cut down a bamboo grove. The bamboo grove was something that somebody had planted at one point, and, you know, it had kind of taken over, and so they were cutting it back. And I met a Southeast Asian woman who was there, with basically a knife that looked almost as large as a machete, was digging into the new young shoots. So she was foraging for bamboo shoots. And it was the first time I had ever eaten a fresh bamboo shoot. And it was amazing. It was so much better than the stuff that you get out of a can.
Really?
Yeah.
And the bamboo shoot is just from wild bamboo growing.
Well, I'm pretty sure somebody had planted this bamboo grove, probably for ornamental reasons, and then when they left the property and the nature preserve basically bought it up, someone at some point decided to cut the grove back, because you know how quickly bamboo grows.
Right, right, absolutely.
This very hardy woman decided, oh, you know, look, the bamboo, they've cut the bamboo back, but, you know, each year the shoots come up right around April or May. And she was, you know, just being very thrifty and resourceful, and cutting, you know, and basically digging up the bamboo shoots that nobody wanted anyway.
Uh-huh. Let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some, you know, people's criticism sometimes, like you were just talking about, you know, she's being thrifty, nobody wanted these anyway, but some people look at foraging as, you know, not a sustainable thing. Like, if everybody was doing that, what would happen? So let's touch on that when we come back. Let's just take a couple-minute break. Everybody, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green and my guest, Ava Chin. Be right back.
Anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me, since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. Insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal on Insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green, and I'm here with my guest today, Ava Chin, talking about her book, Eating Wildly and Foraging. Ava, you with me?
Yes.
Great. So anyway, you know, some people, you know, have commented about foraging as it not being sustainable and that it's almost, you know, digging into nature and taking, you know, and if everybody did that, there would be nothing left. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion on that? What do you say about that?
Sure. So, I have a comment that's, sort of two sections. And the first is, there's a difference between foraging for your own personal consumption and foraging on a commercial basis. I'm not a commercial forager. I do it for myself, to supplement nutrients for myself and my family and to be connected in nature. So I can't really speak about commercial foraging, but the foragers that I know who forage for themselves understand that in order for your food, to come back year after year, you have to forage sustainably. You don't want to decimate the plant, right? You you want it. To forage sustainably means you forage in such a way that the plant continues to grow even after you've picked a certain percentage of it. The litmus is usually about, you know, I say like no more than 20% of the plant, and you pick it from the places that are renewable, meaning that you pick it from its growth nodes and it can continue to flourish after you've left. So I think that is really, really important. The other thing is that
so you're not digging up the roots when you
that's
forage.
That's right. You leave the roots of the plants alone. And you really only pick the things that are renewable, so like maybe a certain percentage of the leaves, like no more than 10 or 20% of the leaves, right? Mm-hmm. And it depends on what you're picking. So what it means is that you have to be aware of the plant in all of its different stages, right? And also how the plant grows. And most of the plants that foragers consume and harvest from really are the same plants that are other people consider weeds, and gardeners and even gardeners at the parks department are I often see weeding it out. And I think if only, you know, you could give those to a forager, they would be very happy to receive it, or use a forager to, you know, weed out some of those weeds that you don't want, right?
Do you know if do the public parks use pesticides and herbicides?
Oh, they do.
They do. I would think so.
Yeah. They don't use it in such great quantities as, say, our industrial agriculture, but they do lay down pesticides and herbicides, which I think is a real shame because those chemicals stay, you know, enter our ecosystem and then end up affecting our bees, right? And so I think that it's actually more sustainable to forage in that regard if you're going to be weeding those plants out anyway. That said, there are certain plants like ramps that could potentially be more endangered because ramps are the kinds of native plants that can only be found in the wild. Our industrial agriculture has not figured out yet how to cultivate them, or at least I don't know of anybody who's cultivating ramps, right? So in order to get ramps, which are very tasty and very delicious, you need to get a forager to go out in the wild and bring them back. ramps should be forged sustainably, like leaving the roots in the ground, right? Not mm-hmm. taking the entire plant. If the patch is really small, you leave the patch alone, right? And you check back another year or so to see how it's doing. That's how I forge for ramps. And I only do it, you know, I've helped friends find ramps patches in their backyards. And things mm-hmm. like that. But if the patch is really small, we just leave it alone, you know. We just let the ramps grow because we want the ramps to come back again and to continue to flourish. So the other thing I would say to sustainable foraging and the issue of, like, if everybody foraged, like, if everyone in New York City decided to go out foraging, what would the impact on the environment be? I think that it's actually a bit of a far-reached idea because in New York City anyway, I live in a city where it's a lot easier to order takeout or to go out to a restaurant than it is to learn how to forage and to go out and pick things for your own food. So I don't really see that happening. To me, that's just sort of like an extreme possibility that is really not grounded in reality.
Right. I agree with you. You know, unless, you know, Armageddon happens and everybody's trying to find food, but that would
right.
be a whole different issue.
That will be. And in which case, you know, I'm certainly happy to teach people how to forage for, you know, the wonderful weeds that grow around us, like the dandelions, like the lamb's quarters. And these things grow in abundance, mm-hmm. you know. So
now, can you take a ramp roots? Like if you go to a little ramp patch, can you transplant them and try to help them spread?
You know, I've thought about that, but I myself am not, you know, I live in a large apartment building. I don't have access to a garden, so I've never actually done it. But I've heard tale of other people trying, but the results are still a little too early to mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. Ramps need a lot of water, so they often grow by little brooks and streams. Mm-hmm. So unless you have those conditions, they won't necessarily thrive.
Right, right. So I know you have a daughter. How old is she?
She's three.
Three. Are you introducing her to foraging?
Oh, yeah. She went on her first morel mushroom hunt.
Ooh,
when she was, you know, when she was about 1 year old. And so we taught her about morels and false morel mushrooms. I've taught her how to forage for blackberries in England. My husband is English, and we go to England about once a year. And
uh-huh.
the blackberries are really rampant throughout England, as are the stinging nettles. And we've taught her about both.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So she really enjoys foraging.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would think it's just such a wonderful thing for young people, for anything to be outside. I mean, you know, right now we're dealing with this horrible cultural new situation of kids not even knowing what to do when they go outside,
right.
Like even how to play outside with, you know, away from their computers or laptops or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, getting them connected to nature and to what grows is just an amazing thing.
Yeah.
So do you teach, I know you mentioned taking groups. You take groups out to teach them how to forage or to...
On occasion.
Go ahead.
Yeah, on occasion I do. I don't do it that often. Mm-hmm. There are other people who run foraging tours more often than I do, but this weekend I am going up to the Longhouse Food Revival, Molly O'Neill's Longhouse Food Revival.
Where's that?
That's in, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing the name of the town, but it's in Rensselaerville, mm-hmm. New York, upstate. Rensselaerville, yeah. And that's this weekend, and we'll be taking a nature walk on the edge of a nature preserve. And that, I think, will be a lot of fun. There'll be a lot of food writers there, and we're focused on Chinese-American food and the Chinese-American experience. So it'll be fun to get these food writers out in touch with nature and doing that.
Oh, wonderful. So is it
marketed for food writers, or it just happens to be that there's going to be a lot of food writers
there? It's marketed for food writers, so whatever stage you're at, if you're a beginning food writer and you just want to, learn more about the subject and how to get published, and then it's also for more experienced food writers who just want to kind of up the ante and bring up their ratchet it up a notch. So I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now, in your book, you also talked about brushing mushrooms off with a brush as opposed to washing them. And as a chef,
right,
I know that. Can you share with my listeners as to why we brush mushrooms instead of washing them?
Right. So mushrooms themselves inherently are filled with a lot of moisture. So the idea of introducing more moisture to them, I think, is anathema to most of us who really love eating mushrooms. That said, I do know of folks who do soak mushrooms in salty water sometimes, like morel mushrooms, if they found it in a salty, loamy place. I do know mushroom hunters and mycologists who soak those in salty water. But there's a whole other camp that I belong to that really believes that, you know, if you just brush the dirt off, it's way better for the consistency of the mushroom when you cook it in your food. So that's why I always advocate. I mean, you can use a brush. I usually just use my fingers.
Mm-hmm. I usually just wet, like, the edge of a paper towel
right,
and brush it with that.
Yeah, that's another
thing. And that works really well, too.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the mushrooms? Because I do that even with, you know, like the oyster mushrooms and the mushrooms that have lots of folds in them that you can't really get to all the different parts.
Right.
What do you do with those? Do you just kind of surrender that you might be eating a little bit of dirt, but that's okay?
Yeah, I generally, if it's
too,
a really dirty part, I will cut it off.
Uh-huh.
And then, so like my maitake mushrooms, that mm-hmm, hand of the woods mushrooms that are so wonderful and are so pricey in our gourmet markets, those grow at the base of oak trees, and they'll grow around blades of grass and oak leaves. So oftentimes when I find a hand of the woods mushroom, the stem of it is often growing in the dirt. So I'll, you know, cut those parts off, the dirty parts off.
The stems are tough anyway, so
yeah,
I cut them off as
right,
well.
Yeah, that's right. See, yeah. So that's generally what I do. The
mm-hmm,
other thing I wanted just to mention about eating wildly is that in as much as it's about foraging, it is really a food memoir and about my own personal connection with the food, things that I learned from my Chinese family members about what foods are medicinal, what foods are, good for headaches or women's conditions. These were things that my Chinese grandfather taught me about, and that really helped set my palate, and I think opened it up for when I decided to, in earnest, eat a lot of wild foods. So the story is a mix of foraging as well as family and cultural history.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I've read little inserts of it. I'm waiting for the book to arrive so I can really read it from cover to cover. But, the little bits that I read is just, you know, beautiful. Talking about your grandmother, when she passed, your relationship with your grandfather who was a chef in a Chinese restaurant, correct?
Mm-hmm. He learned from the chefs at the restaurants he worked in. He was generally a bartender and a manager.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, when you have that cultural history, you know, so much of the traditions, by writing a food memoir, you're sharing those traditions that so often get lost with time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this keeps them alive, and it's so important. You know, that's one of the things, one aspect of slow food that I really love is how they really try to support the traditions and talk about them and bring them back so that they don't get lost. You mentioned just briefly just now about the medicinal qualities of so much of the food that you can forage for. And,
you know, we don't really look to nature enough to heal us when so much of what would be good for us is right there. Instead, we look to drug companies and take a pill, and and the wisdom of our ancestors is so rich. So anyway, I love the work you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bhavani. It's great to talk to you.
Great. So just really quickly, I guess we're out of time. Can you just quickly share with everyone your website so that they can find out when you're doing events?
Yes, it's www.avachin.com.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining me, Ava. And everybody out there, thank you for listening in. It's been wonderful, and I'll be with you again next week. Bye for now.